Half Price Horror.
Hello and welcome to Half Price Horror, where we get our terror at a discount and pass the savings on to you. Half Price Horror is a spoiler-heavy podcast that takes a deep dive into scary movies curated by the selection at the local Half Price bookstore. I'm your host, John, and today we'll be taking a look at A Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master, from 1988. Written by William Kotzwinkel, Brian Helgeland, Jim Wheat, and Ken Wheat, both collectively credited as Scott Pierce, and directed by Rennie Harlan. And I feel like those credits already tell a story. We know that this movie came out only a year after Part 3, and we know that it had four writers. Wes Craven was given a credit as well, but it was only for the inclusion of the Freddy character. He had no involvement in this movie after his initial pitch was rejected and refused to assist in rewrites. And if you know anything about Hollywood, you know that means this was a rush job. Now, that doesn't necessarily spell disaster. Yes, Halloween 5 came out a year after Halloween 4 and was critically panned, but Scream 2 came out just a year after the original Scream, and a lot of people like it better than the original. But in this case, there were a lot of complicating factors going on related to the 1988 Writers Guild of America strike. I remember this strike from my childhood mainly for its effect on the television shows I was watching at the tender age of 13. It wound up delaying a lot of season premieres because of the timing and length of the strike, and that was pretty memorable in an era where there were only three major networks, and Fox, but the jury was still out on them back then, and they all premiered their new shows pretty much in lockstep. The other reason I remember the strike was because nobody could commission any new scripts, but television was still allowed to rewrite old ones, so Star Trek The Next Generation dusted off some old screenplays commissioned for an abortive 70s relaunch of the original series and reworked them to feature Picard and Riker instead of Kirk and Spock. Another show I enjoyed, Dear John, wound up getting greenlit because it started life as a British sitcom, and so all its scripts were technically rewrites. Oh, and the Smothers Brothers, a pair of comedians I thought were hilarious back then, got their show back after 20-odd years off the air because variety shows got an exemption from the strike. I'll admit, I didn't know all that at the time. I went to Wikipedia to refresh my memory and wound up lost in a rabbit hole for about 5 minutes. But to get back to how all this relates to Freddy, New Line was well aware of the impending writer's strike when they commissioned William Kotzwinkel, whose name was maddeningly familiar to me until I looked him up on Wikipedia and realized I'd read his novelization of the E.T. movie probably a dozen times as a kid, to write a story that was, well, let's just say it fit comfortably into the path already trodden by the previous installment. As always, Never Sleep Again, The Elm Street Legacy, is a great documentary about the franchise, but even there, nobody says what everybody had to be thinking. Dream Warriors provided a perfect formula for the series, and all they needed to do was load up a fresh group of teenagers and start bumping them off one by one. As a result, I think it's fair to say that the screenplay was not high on the priority list. Brian Helgeland, who would go on to fame as a writer and director of movies like Payback and A Knight's Tale, but who had at the time just finished writing a script for Robert Englund's directorial debut 976 Evil. I know, it really does keep coming up in these episodes, doesn't it? He fleshed out Kotzwinkel's outline, but the story was still very much in flux when the strike began and both men went out onto the picket line. New Line still hadn't settled on a director yet, but pre-production had already begun based on the material they had because the release date was set in stone. Freddy had now graduated to full summer blockbuster status, and the thing about summer blockbusters was that you could stand to lose a lot of money if you went up against a bigger, flashier blockbuster and took a hit to your opening grosses. So the first thing studios did when they were making a tentpole movie like this was stake out a weekend to prevent another movie from muscling in on their turf. I've seen it said on IMDb that both Tom McLaughlin of Friday the 13th Part 6 fame and Tibor Takash, who directed The Gate, both turned down opportunities to direct this movie because they didn't like walking in so late in the process. This, along with Craven's refusal to come back and salvage a film that was looking scarily like it might not meet its release date, left an opening for a young man from Finland named Rennie Harlan, who had directed a movie in his home country called Born American that did good business and enticed him to come to America, where he directed another movie, 1987's Prison, that was released almost unnoticed. It's since gone on to be a bit of a cult classic, mainly because it was an early role for a young Viggo Mortensen. Harlan needed a job pretty badly after prison flopped, so he just started showing up at the New Line offices week in and week out asking if they had any movies that needed directing. Bob Shea was reportedly pretty cool to the idea of having a relatively new director whose English wasn't great for what was shaping up to be another expensive and complex special effects extravaganza, but he was very low on options and that release date just kept getting closer. Chuck Russell, who you'd think would be the natural choice after Part 3, had pushed all his chips to the center of the table in a gamble on an expensive remake of 1958's The Blob, but that's a whole other story. Shea finally decided to hire Harlan, and the movie went into production with an underbaked script and a lot of completed FX gags that needed to be worked into the story as they went. It also went into production without Patricia Arquette. According to a 2017 interview with the website Bloody Flicks, she didn't want to stay in the horror genre and she had no interest in reprising her role. And this was back in the days before they'd lock actors up with two or three picture deals to make sure they didn't have to recast. I can't imagine that her experiences with Chuck Russell on the set of Part 3 made her any more inclined to return either. Instead, they went with unknown actor Tuesday Knight to play Kristen. That's K-N-I-G-H-T. Knight had done a very few roles before this movie. Guest appearances on Fame and The Facts of Life, and a TV movie called Promised a Miracle, according to IMDb, but this is by far her most famous film appearance, although she does seem to have more recently embraced her genre status with parts in Shriek Show, The Rideshare Killer, Attack of the Radioactive Zombies, and The Creeps. Rodney Eastman and Ken Sagos do return as Joey and Kincaid, though, along with Brooke Bundy as Kristen's mom Elaine, and of course Robert Englund as Freddy Krueger. Famously, Sagos and Eastman both thought they would get an expanded role in the sequel, only to discover once they got the script that their characters were killed off in the first act. It's worth watching Never Sleep Again just to hear Ken Sagos talk about how he told his friends, "If you're coming to the movie to see me, don't stop to buy popcorn." As always, the survivors of a horror flick are usually the first loose ends to be tied up when the monster comes back. And this makes way for a new group of friends, one centered on Alice Johnson, as played by Lisa Wilcox. Wilcox started out doing guest spots in 80s TV shows and after-school specials, and I think this might be a good time to correct a mistake I made, because I said in my American Mary episode that Tristan Risk began her career with a movie called Killer Babes and the Frightening Film Fiasco, but Wilcox is in that as well, and it also shows up at the beginning of her IMDb page, and it appears to be because that film has no release date on the site, so it just defaults to putting it at the bottom. So that movie was made at some point in both women's careers. Or possibly hasn't been released yet. Who knows? In any event, Wilcox reprises her role as Alice for the next movie, and in recent years it looks like she too has decided to hop on board the genre train with films like Dead Country, Fear Clinic, Savage, The Bloody Man, Dark Ritual, The Black Mask, Reunion from Hell 2, and the intriguingly titled films Don't Suck and Teddy Told Me To. She was also in the short film The Quiet Room, which was directed by Sam Weinman of the Odsterian podcast that I've mentioned a couple times on here, and that I'm a big fan of. The friend-slash-victim group is composed of Debbie, played by Brooke Theiss, Sheila, played by Toy Newkirk, and Dan, played by Danny Hassel, as well as her brother Rick and her father Dennis, played by Andrus Jones and Nicholas Melle, respectively. Theiss is a working actor who's primarily known for completing the trifecta of performers who appeared in both the Elm Street movies and the TV show Just the Ten of Us, which is just one of those incredibly weird little factoids about the franchise that everyone involved is amused by, while Toy Newkirk has mostly gone behind the camera as an executive producer for Terraform Films after a series of guest roles and day player parts in the 1990s. Danny Hassel, meanwhile, returned for the sequel despite being convinced that he was probably an afterthought on the part of the producers. His character was unnamed in the original screenplay, and they simply gave the actor's name to the role he was playing, but he didn't really act much beyond that. He's had a few parts here and there, including the aforementioned Reunion from Hell 2, but he went into the military following the 9/11 attacks, and as near as I can find out, he's still serving to this day. While Andrus Jones has mostly eschewed acting, apart from memorable roles in the cult video game Night Trap and in cult films The Attic Expeditions and Sorority Babes in the Slimeball Bolorama, probably the most memorable title in horror history, in favor of a career as a musician and radio host. He has a regular show, Radio 8 Ball, where he uses random song selections as a sort of divination tool, like tarot cards or yarrow sticks, to tell the fortunes of his celebrity guests. And I'd say that was the weirdest career path of any actor in this series, but then I remember Jesu Garcia and walk that back a little. And Mele is a character actor and day player who is on things like Remington Steele, Amazing Stories, TJ Hooker, Cagney and Lacey, and Seinfeld, and honestly I might not have mentioned him save for the fact that he's also in Part 5 and he probably gets the closest thing to a character arc that you're going to see in the later Freddy sequels. Speaking of, let's dig in. And just in case you didn't get the idea that everyone is trying as hard as possible to evoke popular Part 3, this one also begins with a quote. This time at least it's accurate. It's from the Book of Job. When deep sleep falleth on men, fear came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones to shake. I suppose you could make a connection between Alice and the sufferings of Job, but I suspect I'd be giving the creators a little too much credit if I suggested that was intentional. At this point in the franchise, we are all about replicating that spooky carnival atmosphere of Part 3, and Wes Craven's subtext has gone out the window. Case in point, after the opening credits, which play to a song called Nightmare, sung by Tuesday Knight herself as part of her modestly successful music career, we cut to Kristen, once again outside the house on Elm Street and once again meeting the same little kid from Part 3. Bob Shea micromanaged this installment the same way he did the others, and I have to believe he was very big on the idea of replicating the formula that made Dream Warriors such a hit. This nightmare is just straight up, hey, did you like the last movie? You're gonna love this one! But of course Freddy is dead, as we saw at the end of the last movie, and so the house is empty and the boiler is cold. Something Joey and Kincaid remind Kristen of with no small amount of exasperation when she drags them into her nightmare for reassurance. The way they say it makes it sound like this has become something of a common occurrence now that Kristen knows she has the superpower to pull other people into her dreams, and they're beginning to get more than a little annoyed about it. I know that both Sagos and Eastman made a lot in the documentary about how hard it was to establish chemistry with Knight knowing that she was the replacement for Arquette, but honestly I think that kind of works in the movie's favor because the characters are supposed to be frustrated with her and maybe a little bit over her constant neediness, even though that's a very understandable reaction for someone who's probably experiencing PTSD after months of fighting for her life every night. Whatever reassurance Joey and Kincaid give, though, is undercut when Kincaid's dog leaps out of the empty boiler and clamps his jaws down on Kristen's arm. She wakes up with a nasty bite, the dog wakes up with blood on his muzzle, and her fears of Freddy's impending return only worsen. It may not have been the filmmaker's intention, but given what we see in both the original movie and Freddy vs. Jason about Krueger drawing strength and power from the fear of his victims, I have to imagine that this is what empowers him to return and not, well, we'll get to it soon enough. Suffice to say, I have issues. The next morning, Kristen stops by the Johnson house to pick up her wise-ass boyfriend Rick and his mousy, timid sister Alice to bring them to school. Rick and Alice's dad is a short-tempered and nasty man who's still nursing a hangover from the night before, which is about the closest this film gets to any of the heaviness and serious topics of these previous installments. There's no mental institutions here, no death by suicide, no sexual assault, nothing dark or bleak or potentially upsetting to right-wing censors. And on the one hand, it is kind of sad to see the series simply sanding off all its rough edges to become pure slasher fluff, and you can say that this film isn't grounded in anything to offset the campiness of the Freddy material and it becomes almost too comical as a result. But on the other hand, it's not like Dream Warriors actually handled any of its subject matter especially well, so maybe it's for the best if we don't have any of it around. At school, we meet Debbie, who's a bodybuilder who hates bugs, and Sheila, who's smart and has asthma, and Alice's crush Dan, who is handsome and plays football. As with the previous film, each character is given exactly two personality traits, just enough to give them a hook for their cool and visually inventive dream death, and even though the actors lean into them entertainingly, I especially like the way Toy Newkirk pushes her huge glasses up her nose, it's still not a lot to hang your hat on. Alice gets a little more development as the main character, with a moment between her and Dan that establishes her as a chronic daydreamer, but even she doesn't get much of a story arc. This is all about the kills, and everyone is getting just enough of a perfunctory setup to establish them as stereotypes before those kills begin. Joey and Kincaid warn Kristen that if she doesn't get a handle on her emotions, then she might stir Freddy back up again, but that's not exactly actionable advice, and frankly, they come off as real jerks. Again, that's partly due to the behind-the-scenes drama, but it really works for the scenes given the tensions in their respective friendships. Rick chases them off with a veiled homophobic taunt I could have done without, but it's the 80s and that was unfortunately very much the standard, and he walks off with Kristen as behind them we see deep slashes in the lockers that glow with a hellish light. That evening, we see Rick's second character trait. In addition to being a wise-ass, he knows martial arts, and I do just mean martial arts, because this was an era where all of martial arts and all of Asian culture were lumped together and exoticized by filmmakers who grew up on old Shaw Brothers kung fu movies and exploitation films that fetishize ninjas to a downright ludicrous degree, and he and Alice have an angry confrontation with their dad about his alcoholism that turns out to be another one of Alice's daydreams. And at night, Kincaid falls asleep and wakes up with his dog in the junkyard where Freddy is buried. Only it's a nightmare version, a maze of rusted-out cars and scrap metal that stretches all around the world in an absolutely amazing pullback shot. I remember seeing a special when I was a kid where they showed how this was made. It's a neat trick where they made a matte painting with a hole cut into it to composite with the crane shot of Sagos in the actual junkyard set, and little winking lights to represent the headlights of the various junk cars. It's very cool, but I'm talking around the big dumb moment. Kincaid's dog Jason runs over to where Freddy is buried, pawing at the dirt for a few moments before, pissing fire onto it. I mean, that's what happens on screen. The dog urinates, it catches fire midstream, and when it sprays onto the ground, it apparently does that Simpsons joke of unholying the holy water and frees Freddy, even though this is only a dream and not the actual spot where he was buried, which presumably has not been pissed on by a dog. Then again, Jason had Kristen's actual blood on his muzzle, so maybe it works in reverse, too? Or maybe there's just no point in applying logic here because they needed to bring Freddy back somehow and there was no way of doing it that wouldn't be cataclysmically stupid. Freddy's body reconstitutes in a scene that's very reminiscent of Hellraiser from the previous year, and Freddy says to Kincaid, "You shouldn't have buried me. I'm not dead." And yes, as every single IMDb commenter felt the need to point out independently in the trivia and the goof section, his lips don't move. Kincaid uses his super strength to crush Freddy with a junked car, but as established in the previous movie, the cool dream superpowers everybody has don't actually do anything useful in terms of fighting Freddy, and Krueger simply stabs him to death. That's at the 20-minute mark, so popcorn lines must have been pretty long in 1988. Because Kristen is still awake, having resumed her caffeine habits, she has no idea that Kincaid is dead, and the others don't have the ability to drag anyone into their dreams, so they're on their own. And with Kincaid dead, Joey is the next target. As we recall from the previous movie, he has exactly one character trait, being horny, and as he falls asleep watching MTV, he has a very music video-inspired dream of a naked woman showing up inside his waterbed shortly before she becomes Freddy and slashes open the mattress, killing him in a pool of water. With the line, "How's this for a wet dream?" Because we're now officially in the era of Freddy Krueger post-kill dad jokes. His mother, played by Jacqueline Mashey, finds him dead inside the waterbed, and we aren't even going to bother with the whole the adults think it's all weird accidents thing, because this makes Jennifer's death with the TV set in part 3 look downright believable. Back at the Johnson house, Alice looks at the mirror that she's covered over with photos of her friends and family, which would be a nice subtle metaphor about how she doesn't really live her own life, if not for the fact that Rick walks right in and says loudly, "That kind of defeats the purpose of having a mirror, doesn't it?" We are not at a point in the franchise where they have a lot of respect for the audience's intelligence, basically. They exposit a little about the way Dad's falling apart after Mom's death, and Rick tries to teach Alice to stand up for herself with nondescript martial arts in a scene that's kind of cute but is mainly there to let us know Alice can't do them. This will be important later. The next morning, Kristen is freaking out over Kincaid and Joey's seeming absence from school, and she and Alice bond a little over their respective nightmares of the night before, but Alice explains that she doesn't usually have nightmares, because her mother taught her a rhyme about the Dream Master that she no longer remembers, but that she still uses to lucid dream herself somewhere better whenever she finds herself in a dreamscape she doesn't like. Which is all really clunky third act setup, but I do like the way Wilcox plays the scene as though she doesn't realize that she's the protagonist. I don't know how many people were actually fooled in 1988 into thinking that Kristen was the focus of the story, but they're certainly not telegraphing the next big twist. Kristen goes into class and sees the empty desks where Joey and Kincaid should be sitting and immediately panics. Rick grabs her, trying to calm her down, but when she pulls away, she cracks her head and winds up passing out. She wakes up in the nurse's office, where they once again do the, oh my god, this is secretly a dream and the nurse is secretly Freddy Krueger riff from part 3, but this time with an out-of-makeup Robert Englund in the nurse's outfit, and she wakes up again, this time knowing that Freddy's back and she's the last of the Elm Street kids. Which is something of a plot corner that the franchise has written itself into because both the first and the third movie establish pretty clearly that Freddy is taking his revenge by going after the children of the people who burned him alive, and he's about to finish off the last one with over an hour still to go in the movie. Again, I think Wes Craven was right to just ditch that angle in his script for part 3, but it's a little late for that now, and so just like Freddy's death at the end of the previous movie, that needs to be retconned away. After school, Alice is working her job at a restaurant called the Crave Inn, get it, when Dan comes in looking for Rick. Debbie winds up taking his table, and there's a little bit of banter between the two of them and Sheila about boys that doesn't exactly help this movie pass the Bechdel test, but is nonetheless kind of sweet and charming. And perhaps points to a little ace representation for Sheila, who shows no interest in boys or sex. It's all interrupted when Rick and Kristen come racing in with news of the deaths of Joey and Kincaid, which is our cue for this installment's lore drop about Freddy Krueger, the notorious child killer, delivered at Nancy's house, which is now fully abandoned and boarded up and referred to as Freddy's home. Cue all of my previous rants about how they don't really let one house in a suburban neighborhood get abandoned and boarded up and dilapidated, they would just tear it down or renovate it. The lore dump, which comes as news only to Dan, who's apparently only recently moved to Springwood, is in turn interrupted when Kristen's mom Elaine shows up to bring her daughter home and inject a little campy energy into the film. She feeds Kristen dinner spiked with sleeping pills, having once again decided that the problem is just that her daughter isn't getting enough rest despite the dozen or so deaths related to this, and she must have given her a dangerously high dose because Kristen barely makes it up to her bedroom before collapsing onto the floor. Rennie Harlan gives the whole scene a wonderfully disorienting quality by shooting it from directly overhead and constantly spinning the camera, and honestly, it's no wonder that Wes Craven said this was his favorite movie that he didn't direct himself. Harlan knows how to give you some pretty damn good razzle-dazzle when he wants to. Kristen tries Alice's advice of lucid dreaming herself somewhere beautiful and winds up lounging on a beach in a bikini. Apparently, Harlan pushed for her to wear something skimpier, and several cast members at the time commented that his attention to Knight on the shoot felt vaguely inappropriate even though they assumed it was consensual. But Freddy's glove emerges from the water like the shark's fin in Jaws and swims right up into the sand before Freddy himself explodes out of the dirt. When Kristen runs, she sinks straight into a patch of quicksand, and Freddy puts on a pair of sunglasses before pushing her all the way under in a moment that's been memed more times than I can count. But instead of dying, Kristen emerges onto the ceiling in the house on Elm Street, and it soon becomes clear that Freddy isn't just out to kill her. He's trying to get her to bring someone else into her dreams so that he can increase the potential victim pool. Kristen panics and calls on Alice, and the second she's outlived her usefulness, Freddy kills her and drains her soul into his own. This leaves Alice in Freddy's dream alone, stuck with Freddy and the screaming souls of his victims literally embedded into his body, and she absorbs Kristen's dream power shortly before waking back up. And I do like that this kind of turns the plot problem into a plot device by making Alice suddenly the focus of the movie, but it does feel like it needed another draft or two. As written, Kristen gives Alice her ability to pull others into her dreams, telling her she'll need it to survive, but without that power, Alice wouldn't be able to provide Freddy with any more victims, and his reign of terror would have ended. it really would have made more sense for Freddy to bequeath the power to her, perhaps awakening her latent ability to steal the dream powers of others, which is otherwise never explained. But again, this was all being rewritten on the fly by Harlan as shooting problems emerged, and no screenwriter could be drafted to deal with them, so it's no wonder there are some plot problems here and there. Rick and Alice go to Kristen's house as quickly as they can, but she's dead, her body burned in the supernatural fires of Freddy's boiler room, and we next see her funeral as she's laid to rest next to Nancy Thompson, Donald Thompson, and Roland Kincaid in what's apparently the Freddy's Victims section of the cemetery. I think that was probably a few Easter eggs too many, even if I do understand the impulse. Afterward, Alice and Rick watch videos of their friends in happier times, with Rick berating himself for not staying close to his girlfriend, and Alice trying unsuccessfully to convince him that what she saw in her dream was real. The next day, Sheila arrives at school having pulled an all-nighter cramming for the physics test and making an ultrasonic bug repeller for Debbie, because nerds in 80s movies were always showing up with homemade inventions that could do the impossible. I will say that I love the fact that Newkirk isn't made to act out any African-American stereotypes, and is in fact made out to be something of a prodigy in an era where black people were usually portrayed as intellectually incurious and academically struggling. Although, the credit for that should be given to Newkirk herself. She said in Never Sleep Again that she was asked to perform her lines in a more stereotypically quote-unquote black way, and flat-out refused. So good for her. Now, you can probably guess what's about to happen next. Well, at least in the general sense you can. In the very specific sense, it's pretty damn weird that a robot arm emerges from Sheila's desk and attacks her, because that's so surreal and inexplicable that it almost feels like it came from another draft of the script and they just happen to have the effect still lying around. But moments later, Alice and Sheila notice Freddy sitting at the teacher's desk, peeling an apple with his claws. Apparently England actually did this for real, having learned how to use the glove pretty well over the last four movies, before he walks over to Sheila and kisses her so hard her entire body deflates. In the real world, it's written off as a fatal asthma attack, but Alice was inside the dream and saw everything. I will say I really love the authenticity of Brooke Thice's response. The way she plays it, you can honestly believe she just lost a close friend. Also, I don't know if it's just coincidence, but Andras Jones is dressed and hairstyled so much like David Boreanaz in the Buffy and Angel TV shows that I genuinely wonder now if this was on some costume designer's mood board, because the resemblance is truly uncanny. Alice takes down the photos of Kristen and Sheila from her mirror, and we see that she's kept the sonic repeller, and we're beginning to get the feeling that she's changing a little as her friends drop away one by one. She starts taking double shifts at the diner to keep herself awake, because, as she explains to Dan, she's beginning to believe that she's now the bridge between the Elm Street kids Freddy's already finished off and the new victims he craves so badly. This does feel a little bit like a lull in the movie, with everyone just standing around and talking about what's happened, but thankfully it doesn't last long. Because the Freddy movies all revolve around an inescapable truth. You can't fight sleep forever. Alice dozes off during an especially boring lecture about dreams, given by Bob Shea, and containing some hints that Alice is herself a kind of oppositional entity to Freddy who guards the dreamscape even if she doesn't know it yet. And Rick dozes off right along with her, even though he's over in the changing rooms by the gym. He's first teased by some cheerleaders while sitting on the toilet, then by a burned and ghastly version of Kristen. The bathroom stall then becomes an elevator, which goes down at a frightening pace. Originally, he was going to die like that when the floor fell out, plunging him down a bottomless shaft, but the budget was almost entirely gone by this point, so they had to come up with something else. Something very cheap. Something, and I cannot express this enough, very, very cheap that would cost the production absolutely no money at all to film. So Rick instead emerges into a mocked-up quote-unquote dojo, which is just some cheap curtains and folding screens, and is beaten up by an invisible Freddy that's very obviously just some pantomime worked with punches and kicks folded in later. Rick fights back, but again, dream superpowers in this series are mostly for show, and he's summarily dispatched by a suddenly visible Freddy glove. Alice wakes up, realizing she's lost him, and the windows of the classroom shatter inward in what I assume has to be a remnant of the dream, because nobody seems to comment on the bizarre supernatural event at any subsequent point. At the funeral, Alice once again tries to escape into daydreams by imagining Rick climbing out of his coffin having faked his death. But the fantasy brings nothing but pain, and she forces herself to emerge from it. She's becoming more grounded, more determined in her desire to beat Freddy once and for all, and she's also taking on traits of her friends' personalities as they pass away. Something Debbie and Dan comment on in a scene that's very clearly spelling things out for the inattentive in the audience. Also spelling things out a bit too much, albeit with a little more of a cool factor, is that Alice can suddenly use Rick's nunchucks without any issue, or at least the person we see from behind who's wearing a brunette wig, despite the fact that Wilcox very specifically had to dye her hair red for the role, can use them. I try not to comment on the switch to a stunt double, but this feels so transparently obvious that it's like they wanted you to spot it. Incidentally, this scene of all scenes was heavily trimmed for the UK release. The British censors didn't have much of an issue with the supernatural violence because it was so fantastical, but they really didn't like it when a character did something they thought a child might try to imitate, so they cut a chunk out here. It's since been restored. Debbie, Dan, and Alice decide to meet up at the diner that evening and come up with a plan to defeat Freddy. At dawn, we plan! But Alice is delayed by her still drunk but now overprotective father. She finally sneaks out the same way her brother used to and makes for the diner, but Dan's not there, and she finds herself inexplicably drawn to the movie theater across the street instead. Reefer Madness is playing, a nice little nod to the old days when Bob Shea used to distribute the public domain film on college campuses. But when she goes into the auditorium, the screen is showing a dilapidated and ruined version of the Crave Inn, and before she knows it, Alice and her snacks are literally sucked into the screen to land inside the movie. This was a very slick trick done with a gradually tilting set. The effects in this movie were mostly done by R. Christopher Biggs and John Carl Buechler of Friday the 13th Part 7 fame, with assists by Howard Berger and Kevin Yeager and one very special artist we'll talk about in a moment, and they really got their money's worth out of every gag. Alice goes inside the diner to find an elderly, exhausted version of herself still polishing silverware, having achieved nothing in her drab and boring life, and I'm so impressed by the makeup because it's really not overdone or melodramatic, it just looks like an older version of the character. Elderly Alice serves young Alice a pizza, which Freddy invites himself to share, and I do kind of wish they hadn't gone so dad jokey with this scene in particular, because I think this is the heart of the film and it's got an undercurrent of real menace they could have exploited to memorable effect. As it is, Freddy eats the heads of Alice's friends off of the pizza while making jokes about soul food, and it's only at the end when he looks at her and snarls, "Bring me more," that you realize this is the devil's bargain he's offering her. If Alice wants to survive, she has to drag people into the dreamscape for Freddy to murder and devour, and her unconscious mind is so terrified it's involuntarily doing his bidding even though she tries to stop herself. This really could have brought home the terrifying idea, but instead Freddy's nomming on a meatball with Rick's face and it just feels silly. And not even the good kind of silly. Alice drags Debbie into the dream, and Freddy then wakes her up in her own bedroom. She never left the house, it was all just her sleeping imagination. She goes running to get Dan and bring him to Debbie's house in time to prevent Freddy from killing her, but they keep looping back to the diner again and again and again, and it soon becomes obvious they're still dreaming. And while they do, Debbie... Okay, this is the scene everybody remembers from this movie, and for good reason. Screaming Mad George, the special effects artist behind such vividly imaginative body horror films as Society, The Giver, and Bride of Reanimator, was brought in to do a special transformation sequence that is utterly jaw-dropping in its blend of realism and surrealism as Freddy pushes down on Debbie's barbell while she's weightlifting, and her arms break at the elbows to expose a pair of monstrous cockroach appendages. She flees, gradually turning into a bug like some sort of hair metal Gregor Samsa, only to find herself running through a giant glue trap that sticks her feet to the ground and holds her in place. When she falls over and tries to tear her body free, the flesh simply rips away, leaving her fully roachified, and Freddy crushes the trap with her still inside it and delivers the dad joke line, "You can check in, but you can't check out." God alone knows what her real-life corpse looked like. I can't imagine it would be easy to write that off as a suicide. Dan and Alice wake up having hit a tree while attempting to run Freddy down in their dreams, and while Alice is relatively uninjured, Dan is pretty badly hurt. Alice can't stop the doctors from sedating him for surgery, so she instead races home in preparation for a final dream confrontation with Freddy. You famously don't dream under general anesthetic. In fact, you're really not aware of the passage of time at all, but real-world logic went out the window several movies ago. Alice takes several sleeping pills, adorns herself with talismanic reminders of the people she loves, and takes the last remaining photos off of the mirror to finally look herself in the eye and see that she's the one Freddy needs to be afraid of, not the other way around. It's a pretty simple narrative arc, but I gotta admit, it plays well to the backseats. Alice goes into the dream to rescue Dan, and I do love that the big strong jock legitimately does play the damsel in distress role here, and they leave the hospital into a spinning tunnel that finally ejects them into an abandoned church because, why not? Dan's woken up from surgery, though, inexplicably and absurdly quickly given that he just inhaled general anesthetic, and it's down to Freddy and Alice for the final fight. She uses her superpowers, Debbie's strength, Rick's martial arts, Sheila's... bug repeller. But again, none of it does any good. You can't beat Freddy like that. In fact, you really can't beat Freddy at all, which is what makes ending these movies so tricky because he's just a dream, and you can't really do anything to hurt a dream. So we get an extremely random climax where Alice suddenly remembers that the Dream Master rhyme she learned as a child ends with, "In the reflection of my mind's eye, evil will see itself and it shall die." And she shows Freddy a piece of stained glass where he sees his own reflection and it kills him. It comes completely and totally out of nowhere. That said, visually it's fantastic. They used a mix of puppetry, animatronics, and at one point an entire fake version of Freddy's torso, some 20 feet tall, to simulate all the souls tearing themselves free from their tormentor one by one. Arms emerge from his neck and shoulders, bodies press against his chest from the inside out, hands made of his own burned skin grab at his chin to tear him apart from within, and it looks freaking amazing. One of the bodies inside Freddy is played by Linnea Quigley, by the way, of Return of the Living Dead fame. Not to say that she's living up to her reputation or anything, but you'll know which one it is because it's nude. The freed souls flee Freddy's body, thanking Alice for releasing them, and she looks down at the smoldering remains of his clothing with a smile of triumph. She emerges from the nightmare into a brighter, happier dream, with Freddy once again diminished into insignificance, and the next day she and Dan have very clearly become a couple after trauma bonding. Dan flips a coin into a nearby wishing well for good luck, and if Alice sees Freddy's reflection in the water for a moment, it's soon rippled away by the impact into nothing. Freddy's gone. Again. For now. Until the grosses for this movie come in, at least. And since the last musical number was such a success, this closing credits has its own signature song that got its own music video on MTV, the Fat Boys rapping Are You Ready for Freddy? And yes, this one also features Robert Englund, and this time he actually participates in the song as well with his own rap about how great he is at killing people. They also sample Heather Langenkamp's Don't Fall Asleep line from the original movie. The video honestly plays into a lot of stereotypes about superstitious and cowardly black people, and frankly, it did not catch lightning in a bottle the way Dream Warriors did, but thankfully it's also less of an earworm, because I had that damn Dawkins song stuck in my head for something like 2 straight weeks while I was working on that episode. Anyway, will I hang on to this movie? I'll be honest, originally I was gonna say no. The paper-thin characters and simplistic plot kind of had me a little underwhelmed, and I do feel like it doesn't have quite the same degree of inventiveness to its dream sequences despite the vivid and imaginative death of Debbie. But after watching Part 3 and Part 4 back-to-back for the podcast, I've come to realize I kind of like a Freddy movie that at least wears its campiness on its sleeve instead of clashing between intensely dark subject matter and a goofy carnival tone. And I've really come to like the performances, too. Everyone seems to be into their part, and I enjoy that, even if the roles are kind of cheesy. Plus, it's once again disappeared from streaming, and I'm really getting sick of that. So yes, I'm keeping my physical copy for the moment. And if you want to talk about that cockroach scene, suddenly remembering that your opponent will die if they see their reflection, or about anything else that came up on this podcast, you can find me on Twitter as @halfhorror, and on Tumblr, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd as @halfpricehorror. My watch list on Letterboxd contains everything I plan to tackle in future episodes. If there's something you'd like to hear about, let me know. You can also support the show at patreon.com/halfpricehorror, and you can rate and review me on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else this podcast is found. And next time on Half Price Horror, isn't that always the way of it? You're through with 2023, you're getting ready for a new year discussing another one of your birthday acquisitions, and then the screaming starts. Oh wait, that's... And now the screaming starts from 1973. That's what we're watching next time. See you then.